weeks before, on June 25th, the Korean War had broken out and North Korean forces had crossed the 38th parallel, capturing Seoul just 3 days later.
The footage obtained from the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration shows bombs being dropped and bodies strewn on the ground. Videos and photos edited from it are organized under four themes to highlight wartime suffering and healing after the 1953 armistice.
The bombing killed at least 1,587 of Yongsan's 193,000 residents, and 47 B-29 bombers dropped some 1,500 bombs, as this bomber was highly inaccurate and had to drop many bombs.
The event draws many curious visitors from Seoul and Greater Seoul's smaller cities and towns.
I'm glad the footage was released. Forgetting this incident would be a tragedy. We should not ignore or hide an unexpectedly large number of civilian deaths an aerial bombing unintentionally caused.
West of Seoul in Incheon, General Douglas MacArthur's statue overlooks the port where he led the famed September 1950 landing that led to the South recovering Seoul.
Some people criticize him because he did not take, at least this is what they say, enough care to minimize civilian casualties during the bombing of Yonsan Station in 1950.
In his latest speech on the anniversary of Korea's liberation from Japan's colonial rule at World War II's end, the same day Korea was divided, the South's president urged inter-Korean peace, the exhibit's underlying message.
East and West Germany achieved unification after 45 years. Division is the biggest obstacle to our growth and prosperity, a tenacious barrier to permanent peace. Like Germany, we can remove it.
The exhibit, which opened recently on the anniversary of the bombing and will run at least until this year's end, serves as a powerful reminder war must never happen on the Korean Peninsula again. Jennifer Chang, Seoul.
As part of a new plot to seize further Palestinian lands, the Jewish National Front, a Zionist organization, has initially agreed to allocate $100 million to register the Palestinian lands in East Al-Quds and the West Bank in name of settlers. The new plan could lead to the eviction of further Palestinians from their homes in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. According to Israeli Peace Now Group, the establishment is encouraging settlers to confiscate more Palestinian lands. The Peace Now noted that the right-wing regime of Israel is seeking to seize more Palestinian lands through the Jewish National Fund.
This regime will do anything in its power to first expand settlements and second to annex more Palestinian areas. And now, with the help of this gang establishment known as the Jewish National Fund, Bennett's regime is working to achieve his goal, that is to back illegal settlement construction.
The fund covers about 17,000 properties, most of them inhabited by Palestinians. Observers say this is the same scenario carried out earlier in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. Palestinian families are fighting legal battles to prove their ownership of the properties amid Israeli efforts to evacuate them forcefully from their homes.
The policy has been adopted many times in the past. Today, the Zionist organization is seeking to forge documents and displace more Palestinians both in West Bank and Al-Quds. They are after imposing their full control over the holy city.
The Jewish National Fund is a Zionist organization founded in 1901 to buy and develop land in Ottoman and Mandatory Palestine for Jewish settlers. Earlier this year, Israeli media reported that Israeli authorities recruited the Jewish National Fund to secretly buy Palestinian land for settlers. Palestinians warned that the move by the Jewish National Fund is another proof for Israel's attempts to illegally seize more land in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds by forced expulsion of real owners. They say, however, that they will never back down and they will continue resisting these Israeli plans. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our red lines, and we won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. This will not happen, their war, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban war comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by their members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war and siege. A recent report by the United Nations Population Fund suggests that 20.7 million Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, while over a million pregnant and breastfeeding women are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition throughout 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the torrential rain and the currency collapse, has also contributed to the deterioration of the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen, the report said. For instance, by the end of June 2021, nearly 7,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,300 associated deaths had been reported, amid concerns that the real number of infections were being underreported. Earlier, the United Nations report reported that it had only received half of what was required for the humanitarian response plan of 2021, which was estimated at $3.85 million, despite donors stepping up their support compared to 2020. Observers say Yemen will continue to face a devastating humanitarian situation that risks turning into famine if the international community does not act urgently. They say the only solution is to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. Capitol Police announced on Monday, 23rd of August, that they had cleared a lieutenant who fatally shot a rioter inside the Capitol during the January 6 attack, after an extensive investigation found that he acted lawfully and potentially saved lawmakers and aides from serious harm or even death. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Capitol Police Clear Officer Who Shot Rioter, Saying He May Have Saved Lives. U.S. Capitol Police announced on Monday, 23rd of August, that they had cleared a lieutenant who fatally shot a rioter inside the Capitol during the January 6 attack, after an extensive investigation found that he had acted lawfully and potentially saved lawmakers and aides from serious harm or even death. The department's decision to formally close the case followed a determination in April by the U.S. Justice Department that charges against the officer were not warranted in the shooting death of Ashley Babbitt, a 35-year-old Air Force veteran, on 6th of January this year. Ashley Babbitt was among a throng of Donald Trump's supporters that began smashing its way through the entrance to the Speaker's lobby, a hallway just off the House floor, while police officers were evacuating lawmakers from the chamber. According to video of the encounter, as people in the mob shattered the lobby's glass doors, Ashley Babbitt tried to climb through a hole in the glass, and a police lieutenant on the other side fired a single shot, hitting her in the left shoulder. After being taken to hospital, Ashley Babbitt died. The actions of the police officer in this case potentially saved members and staff from serious injury and possible death from a large crowd of rioters, the Capitol Police said on Monday, noting that lawmakers were just steps away. If the doors were breached, the rioters would have immediate access to the House chambers, the statement said. Ashley Babbitt was one of five people who died during the assault on the Capitol building and in the immediate aftermath. She has become a martyr-like figure for some on the far right of U.S. politics. Capitol Police investigators determined the officer's conduct was lawful and within department policy, which says a police officer may use deadly force only when the officer reasonably believes the action is in the defense of human life, including the officer's own life, or in the defense of any person in immediate danger of serious physical injury, the statement added. The agency said it would not be identifying the lieutenant because the police officer and the officer's family have been the subject of numerous credible and specific threats for actions that were taken as part of the job of all our officers, defending the Congress, members of Congress, staff, and the democratic process. lawmakers have credited the Capitol police officer who shot Ashley Babbitt with saving their lives. But increasingly, some politicians on the far right have sought to inflame their base over the shooting incident. One House Republican, Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona, who has a history of associating with extremists and white nationalists, accused the police officer of lying in wait to carry out an execution. Former President Donald J. Trump has questioned the shooting of Ashley Babbitt and why the name of the police officer who shot Ms. Babbitt was not released. Donald Trump released a statement this month in which he said Ashley Babbitt was murdered at the hands of someone who should have never pulled the trigger of his gun. "We know who he is," Donald Trump said. Ms. Babbitt's husband has sued to force the release of investigative files related to the shooting, and her family has threatened to seek damages from the Capitol Police for her killing. The Capitol Police Department, like Congress, is not subject to public records requests. Mark E. Schammel, a lawyer who represented the Capitol Police lieutenant, said his client is a decorated veteran who showed tremendous restraint in firing just one shot. He said the lieutenant was nothing short of heroic as he organized and coordinated the defense of the house on 6th of January this year. His willingness to remain steadfast in the face of hundreds of violent, extremist, would-be insurrectionists intent on thwarting Congress from performing its constitutional duties was the type of heroism and commitment that the lieutenant was demonstrated in his almost three decades of law enforcement service, the lawyer Mr. Schammel said. The lieutenant's conduct saved lives and helped to end the violent insurrection.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesby. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli military launched air raids on the Gaza Strip, and this following clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinian protesters during a rally marking the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque 52 years ago. Dozens were wounded, including a 13-year-old boy who was shot in the head, and this has been the worst violence since the deadly invasion of the Gaza Strip in May. Palestinian factions had urged a peaceful commemoration. Hamas called the Israeli use of excessive force against civilians as a regular thing that the Tel Aviv regime is used to. Now, let's get an update from our correspondent. Mona Kandil is in occupied Ramallah. Mona, over to you.
Well, the Israeli forces have continued their crimes against the Palestinians, whether we are speaking about Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, in Al-Quds, or even in the occupied West Bank. Early on Tuesday, Israeli forces raided Balata refugee camp, East Nablus, northern the occupied West Bank. The Israeli army claimed that they stormed Balata refugee camp in order to arrest Palestinians accused by the Israeli forces for taking part in anti-Israeli activities. During this operation, Palestinian youths tried to prevent the Israeli forces from storming the refugee camp. The Israeli forces opened fire at the Palestinians there, killing 15-year-old Imad Hashash. He was standing with his brothers and friends on the rooftop of his home watching the Israeli raid to the refugee camp. Experts are saying that the Israeli forces have used live fire and excessive force against the Palestinians, and that an Israeli sniper who opened his fire towards Imad Hashash. Thousands of Palestinians took part in the funeral processions of Imad Hashash in the refugee camp of Balata, vowing to avenge the ongoing Israeli, the killing of this Palestinian teenager, and vowing to continue the struggle until stopping the Israeli crimes against the people of Palestine.
All right, thank you very much for that update. That was Mona Kandil, the correspondent in Ramallah. So welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najafi, and we're putting the spotlight on the recent Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Joining me in today's show are Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council. From that council, we have Masal Barghouti in Ramallah. And we'll also have Palestinian human rights advocate Amal Wakdan also in Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to both our guests. Let's go to Mustafa. Mustafa, who do you hold responsible for, what's responsible for this recent Israeli raid on Palestinians, both in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank?
Well, the responsible party is one party. It's Israel, and it's occupying power, and its forces, and its army, and its government, and their system of racial discrimination and apartheid against Palestinians. They are responsible for the escalation in Gaza, mainly because they continue the siege in Gaza, which is an inhuman siege that is causing one of the worst kinds of human disasters in the world. And also they are responsible because they have blocked every possibility for reconstruction of the door of the houses that were destroyed by the Israeli army. But more than that, they are responsible because they continue their plans of settlement building, the illegal settlement activities that are violating the international law, but also aim at ethnically cleansing Palestinian people. And we see battles going on in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan and so many other places. In addition to that, the Israelis are using a terrible amount of force against peaceful demonstrators. In particular, I would like to mention Beitar, which is a Palestinian town that has been demonstrating peacefully, demanding the removal of an illegal Israeli settlement and illegal Israeli military stations on their land.
Right.
And they've been met with the terrible force. I mean, seven people have been killed so far in 100 days, and no less than 197 people were injured with live ammunition, and about 3,000 people were injured with other forms of pressure. So in my opinion, Israel is intentionally continuing this kind of oppression because they see that the Palestinian resistance is growing against their occupation and against their system of racial discrimination.
Okay. Now, Amal, as you know, more than 260, maybe 70 Palestinians, including almost 70 children, were killed in the May assaults on the Gaza Strip. Media buildings and infrastructure, water, you know, power stations were hit. And after a couple of months, no reconstruction has gone underway, and that's thanks to the Israeli crippling siege. Who should pay for all the loss of lives, the trauma, and the devastation?
Well, the Israeli occupation, of course, and the international community is totally blind on all these crimes that is violating international law and human rights law, and the UN Charter as well. So the one to blame about in regard to all this is the continuous Israeli occupation of Palestine, all of Palestine, actually, because this apartheid system doesn't hadn't stopped its crime since 73 years of its existence on the land of Palestinians. So they think that the Palestinians should stay silent and accept all these crimes that are committed against them. Well, the Palestinians have the right to resist, and they are resisting peacefully and in armed struggle as well, because they have to defend themselves. And by law, by international law, they are liable to do this. They should resist to free their land and to stop this besiege that has been imposed on Gaza, and the occupation that is continuously committing crimes for 73 years. So there is one party to blame here, is the Israeli occupation, the U.S. and its allies, because they are sponsors of this base, military base in Palestine, and they are equally indicted in these crimes. And the criminal is very well known, and even Human Rights Watch had described this settler colonial entity as being apartheid system, and they were talking about all of Palestine, occupied Palestine of 1948 and 1967. So if Human Rights Watch has reached this conclusion, I'm sure that other institutions, other international institutions, including the UN itself, knows that this is a violation of international law and the Charter of the UN, and it has to be stopped. But it can't be stopped if the U.S. continues to sponsor Israel and to cover its crimes.
Okay, Mustafa, as Amal says, the UN has realized that. We have the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights condemning Israeli killing of Palestinian children. It's reported a dozen children have been killed in the occupied West Bank this year alone. And like I said, nearly 70 kids lost their lives in the May attack on Gaza. So the question is, why the international community, like ML Mission, they are blind? Why is the international community so indifferent to all these atrocities and human rights violations?
They are not completely indifferent, but the problem is that they restrict their intervention to condemnation in the best case scenario, or protest, or declarations, or declaring that Israeli actions are violating international law. The problem that the international community is facing is that they cannot make the next step to hold Israel accountable. and to hold Israel responsible for what they are doing by taking measures, including sanctions, boycotts, divestments. Some people at the grassroots level are doing that through the movement of BDS. Some companies have already started divesting from at least settlement companies that work at settlement, Israeli settlements, like the Norwegian Investment Fund, Ben and Jerry company. But the big step of boycotting BDS, boycotting Israel from countries, has not happened yet. And that is, of course, related to hesitance, related to lack of willingness to take responsibility. It is related also to the activity of the Israeli lobby in these countries. But also, it is related to the fact that some countries try to avoid their responsibility by not taking measures. This is the reason why they restrict themselves to statements and condemnation. And Israel doesn't care about that. Israel doesn't care about statements, does not care about condemnation. Israel will only care about acts of punitive acts, of acts of sanctions that could cost them a lot in terms of economy and also in terms of moral values.
All right. Now, Amal, based on investigations, international intentional lethal force was used by Israeli forces against Palestinians. While, you know, based on international law, force can be justified in the presence of a direct threat to life. And this has not been the case in many cases regarding the Palestinians. So what gives the Israeli regime this audacity to act in this way?
Well, they're acting by orders of their superiors, military superiors and political superiors. In addition to the military unproportionate use of munition against the Palestinians, there are 63 settler Zionist organizations that are working as paratroops side by side with the military, and they're conducting their dirty work. So and just in case the military is going to be questioned, there are settler organizations, and they are very brutal and racist settler organizations, and they can do all these crimes without being traced, without being indicted, without being even questioned. And sorry, but condemnation doesn't do us any good. The discrimination that is practiced against the Palestinians in occupied territories, it's the same discrimination that is being practiced in the international organizations such as the UN and such as the ICC. If the US decided that they want to indict Bashir al-Bashir, for example, of Sudan, or the Serbian former president, they can do this with no question. It is imposed and they can bring him to court. But this has not been the practice when it comes to Israel, because Israel is protected. Israel is part of the USA coalition, in a colonial coalition, I should add, the new colonialism in the Middle East and elsewhere. So they can't, why would they charge them? Why would they account them, make them accountable for all these crimes? Because this new colonial system that is led by the US gives them perfect protection and gives the paratroops, the settler Zionist paratroops that are committing crimes, not only in the West Bank and Jerusalem, but also inside 1948. And they were accountable for all the crimes that were committed in Lid and elsewhere in the Galilee and the Triangle. So these paratroops are working hand in hand with the government and with the military, but no one cares about Palestinian lives. That's why Palestinians are eligible to use all forms of resistance, including the armed force, including the popular resistance, including the legal, diplomatic, and political resistance. But we cannot be squeezed in the corner and be asked to to act peacefully towards any assault, towards any physical assaults against us, and towards aiming guns at young children like Al-Hashash in Balata camp, 16-year-old kid. He was killed by a sniper. It was not a mistake, because they are maiming and killing youngsters in purpose. This is in their in their order codes.
Okay. Now, let me ask Mustafa. As you know, Mustafa, there has been a rush among some Arab states to normalize their relations with the Tel Aviv regime. Has this kind of emboldened Israel to put more pressure on Palestinians and, for instance, what they did in the ethnic cleansing in the Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan neighborhoods?
To some extent, of course. The countries that decided to normalize their relationship to Israel, regardless of what Israel is doing to Palestinians and regardless of the violations of international law, have practically encouraged Israel to proceed with its policies. But to be frank with you, I don't think these normalization acts have really made a big difference. And that is because everybody discovered that these were agreements that relate to security cooperation with Israel, and the scandal of Pegasus, the Israeli spying program, was an indicator of how these countries actually try to get some help from Israel to suppress their own people and to spy on others. It's a pure security arrangement more than anything else, and it has very little political impact. And the proof to that is that the Palestinian struggle continues. The international solidarity with Palestinians have increased. The most recent attack on Gaza and the attack on the people of Jerusalem has created a new situation where more and more and more people worldwide are joining the solidarity movement with the Palestinian people. So all in all, they failed. And the efforts of Mr. Trump to pass the Israeli plan, which is called the deal of the century, also failed. And it will continue to fail. But what things have proven is that the more we struggle on the ground, the more we struggle as Palestinians, as people do in Beta now and in Sheikh Jarrah and in Eileen and in other places, the more solidarity we get. And that's why it is very important time now for Palestinians to be unified in their struggle, to get away from all forms of internal disputes and internal oppression and all other negative things, and concentrate on how we can be unified in a plan of struggle for our rights. Because life has shown that Israel does not believe in a compromise, and those who built their hopes on negotiations with the Zionist system have failed drastically.
Right. Now, Amal, there is also this U.S. support for the Tel Aviv regime, the unwavering and, you know, staunch support. Do you expect any change in Washington's approach toward the Palestinians under the Biden administration?
Not at all. Actually, they're doing what the previous administrations were doing. The relationship with the colonial apartheid entity in Palestine is the same. But what Trump used to do, vigorously, now Biden is doing it diplomatically, but the core of the thing is they want to resume bilateral talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And several envoys had came to Palestine, to occupied Palestine, and started these negotiations. They didn't publicly talk about it, but on the ground, what we see is the real face of the U.S. of the Biden administration. We see that the Israelis are continuing, the Israeli military, political status, etc., etc. They are doing what they have been doing all these years, especially during the Oslo or after the Oslo agreement. 27 years of Oslo had cost us a lot of land. Actually, we don't have enough land now, except for the land that we have our homes on. They confiscated most of the lands, 800 or over 800,000 settlers are in the West Bank, when we had like 120,000 before Oslo. So what is actually going on? Israel is waging, it's escalating its aggression against the Palestinians, especially also in Jerusalem.
Right.
Jerusalem now is under attack daily, and it has been like this before, but now it's escalating. Sheikh Jarrah is one case, but one very obvious case of these escalations. And Silwan is the same thing. Mm-hmm. The project of land settlement is, on top of everything now.
Okay.
We call it, Jerusalem now is the battle of all battles.
Right.
We need to unify our efforts to stop this ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem. What they're intending to do is they're intending to steal the rest of the land that has or that is left for the Palestinians.
Okay.
In addition to all the crimes that they commit against the Palestinians, now they are stealing the lands and evacuating homes.
Okay.
Ahmad,
we have only 1 minute left. If you allow me to put one question to Mustafa, and I want to ask Mustafa if the International Criminal Court that's investigating the Israeli crimes against Palestinians, will it be able to bring the perpetrators to justice, or will it be whitewash as usual?
It's not guaranteed. I mean, the ICC is under terrible pressure from the United States, from Israel, from some other countries. Unfortunately, even some European countries are against the investigation of ICC. But the process is going on. And I think we have to continue to demand that ICC fulfills its duty. The picture is clear. There are crimes committed by the Israeli generals and the Israeli government, and they have to be held responsible.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that we have to make sure that ICC continues its work and does not submit to the external pressures that are exercised, and that could destroy, in the case ICC does not proceed with its investigation, it could destroy their reputation.
On that note, we come to the end of the show. Let me thank our guests from Palestine Liberation Organization Central Command. We had Mustafa Bakhouti and Palestinian human rights advocate Amal Vahdan. They both joined us from Ramallah with their contributions. I've been your host, Behrouz Najjar.
It is ridiculous for the United States to chase after its own vaccine skeptics without at the same time doing more to bring the benefits of this scientific achievement to the rest of the world. We now present you an article written by Jeffrey Frankel, a professor of Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. The piece is titled, G20 must prioritize global COVID action at October meeting. Finance ministers, central bank governors, and political leaders are hard at work preparing for the 2021 G20 Heads of State and Government Summit in Rome, Italy, on 30th and 31st of October. With the COVID-19 pandemic stretching well into its second year, the meeting will come at a time of heightened uncertainty about public health and the global economy. And though the mechanisms of international cooperation have been weakened by the pandemic and remain bruised by Donald Trump's legacy, they are more important than ever. Cooperation need not refer to international coordination of national monetary or fiscal policies. For the most part, countries on their own can move those levers in whatever direction is best for them. Instead, the G20 should focus on financial stability, trade, and vaccination. This is in addition to other important areas, especially the existential issue of global climate change, which should and will receive a lot of attention. Over the course of 2020, most countries responded to the health crisis and economic recession with government spending. But emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, cannot finance deficits as easily as can Europe and the United States, with its exorbitant privilege conferred by the dollar's global dominance. Fortunately, many of these countries managed to meet the acute need for increased spending without having to pay sky-high interest rates. Owing to the aggressive monetary stimulus provided by the US Federal Reserve and other major central banks, the initial declines in emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, currencies, security prices and commodity prices in March of 2020 were reversed after the US Federal Reserve's easing. But now it is August of 2021, and every country must contend with a higher debt for GDP ratio. At some point, the US Federal Reserve will signal an end to monetary easing and a coming increase in interest rates. Whenever that happens, investors will pull out of risky assets and lose enthusiasm for their emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Suddenly, EMDE debtors could face potential financial crises like those that struck in the 1980s and 1990s, or on a lesser scale, like the 2013 taper tantrum, when the US Federal Reserve triggered EMDE capital flight by suggesting that it will soon start to wind down its asset purchases. Accepting that there may be a bubble component to today's high prices for risky assets, the financial situation appears particularly fragile. Some say that soaring markets reflect economic fundamentals. For example, high price-to-earnings ratios in the United States stock market are said to be justified by the promise of digitalization and other productivity-enhancing technological innovations. But I would point to the surge in some financial innovations that do not enhance productivity. Think of the 6,000 old cryptocurrencies that have been created, and the rise of many stocks, special purpose acquisition companies, and non-fungible tokens. In any case, the G20 can help to reduce the likelihood and severity of a potential emerging market debt crisis. The debt service suspension initiative that it created during the pandemic was a first step, but it only postponed repayment, and only for one class of international creditors, governments. It is widely recognized that provisions for possible debt restructuring should be extended to cases where the international creditors are private financial institutions, or where Chinese state-backed lenders are claiming to be private. A second step is the new allocation of special drawing rights agreed to by International Monetary Fund IMF members recently. Both initiatives come just in time for emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Early on, it appeared that the impact of the pandemic would be more severe in advanced economies than in many EMDEs, with the exception of South America. But rich countries have since enjoyed unusually strong economic recoveries, aided by macroeconomic stimulus and the vaccines. Meanwhile, the other half has fallen behind. In its most recent global outlook for July of 2021, the International Monetary Fund predicted continued strong growth for advanced economies, but marked down its growth forecast for emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Among developing countries, millions of people are being thrown back into extreme poverty. This economic divergence is particularly striking because it comes on the heels of a global convergence. On average, emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, had been growing substantially faster than advanced economies from the turn of the century until 2014, when Chinese growth started to slow and dollar prices for commodities fell. Among the many explanations for the catch-up period is that global trade increased roughly twice as fast as gross domestic product GDP during the decades preceding the 2008 global financial crisis. However, since 2009, the trend for the trade to GDP ratio has been flat. Unfashionable, as it is to say, the situation today calls for some old-fashioned trade liberalization. The United States and China should roll back the protectionist barriers that they raised over the last 4 years. One sector that is especially ripe for liberalization is trade in environmentally beneficial products, such as the equipment used to produce wind and solar power. G20 member states should work with the World Trade Organization, WTO, to establish new international rules guiding carbon border adjustment taxes so that they can be used but not abused. The G20 also should work with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, to follow through on the exciting recent progress towards the Global Framework for Corporate Taxation. Most importantly, the United States and other rich countries must allocate more of their massive spending packages to make COVID-19 vaccines available to low- and middle-income countries. It is ridiculous for the United States to chase after its own vaccine skeptics without at the same time doing more to bring the benefits of this scientific achievement to the rest of the world. Ruchir Agarwal and Geeta Gopinath of the International Monetary Fund have proposed a plan of action to get more vaccines produced and distributed throughout the world. Even someone who is allergic to altruism should favor programs for vaccination in other parts of the world. So long as the coronavirus runs wild anywhere, it is a danger everywhere. The stakes of international interdependence are higher than ever.